From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The European Parliament and France are beginning investigations of the global eavesdropping system run by the National Security Agency, the most secret of secret U.S. agencies. Mexico's new president takes power, pledging to create a Mexican version of the FBI, and charges dropped against the former Chadian dictator. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands of Vietnam veterans whose names never made it onto the wall at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington because they did not die from battle-related injuries or accidents will now be honored there, though not by name. Under legislation signed by President Clinton last month, a plaque will soon go up near the memorial to honor the veterans who died after the war from exposure to Agent Orange, post-traumatic stress disorder, and other causes not directly related to combat wounds. Experts estimate that the number of veterans who died from those conditions is at least equal to the number of names inscribed on the wall, 5,800-220. Africans south of the Sahara suffer the broadest range of social and economic disadvantages, this according to a new United Nations survey. The survey, called the Human Development Report, examines the availability of schools, clean water, and medical care, and whether people can play a role in politics. It began 10 years ago as an experiment to measure a nation's growth not by economic figures, but by statistical profiles of its people and what they can expect from life. This year, 30 of the 35 countries at the bottom of the index were in sub-Saharan Africa. The countries with the highest human development indicators are from the top: Canada, Norway, the U.S., Australia, Iceland, Sweden, and Belgium. At the bottom, Niger, Burkina Faso, Ethiopia, Burundi, Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, Chad, and the Central African Republic, and Mali. A Palestinian state will be declared by mid-September. On Monday night, the Palestinian Central Council unexpectedly affirmed its commitment to declare a Palestinian state by September 13th, whether or not a final peace deal is reached with the Israelis. That is the target date for a completed deal, although it is highly unlikely it will be met. In a front-page admission of complicity in the slave trade, the Hartford Courant of Connecticut acknowledged that it profited in the 17 and 1800s by publishing scores of ads for the sale of slaves and the recapture of runaways. Such advertisements were commonplace in northern newspapers until the Civil War was underway, but the newspaper said yesterday it felt compelled to apologize for that dark chapter in its history as the nation's longest continuously published daily. Ken DeLisa, a spokesperson for the newspaper, says, "We're not proud of that part of our history and apologize for any involvement by our predecessors at the Courant in the terrible practice of buying and selling human beings that took place in previous centuries." In its story, which ran across the top of the front page, the Hartford Courant noted how it recently had published stories examining how insurer Aetna had apologized in March for having sold policies to slave owners. The stories about Connecticut's slave profiteers had a glaring omission, the Courant itself, the paper said in an account detailing slave ads signed by Thomas Green, who founded the newspaper in 1764. It said the paper ran such ads at least until 1823, and that many ads placed by the owners of runaway slaves offered cash rewards. And this news from San Diego. A new report says many Latino Americans are stuck in low-paying jobs that offer little chance for advancement. The study, released by the National Conference of La Raza, says in 1998, Latinos earned half of what whites did, despite the booming economy, which has provided a lift for many U.S. workers. Researchers say the income disparities could have troubling consequences because Latinos are expected to form a greater share of the nation's workforce in coming years. The editor of the report says a growing but poorer workforce could hurt the nation's ability to compete globally and fund government programs such as Social Security. And this news from Senegal. A court there dismissed charges of torture against the former president of Chad, supported by the U.S., Hissène Habré, who has lived in exile in Senegal since being ousted in 1990. Senegal's judiciary, which has been going through changes since a new president was elected in March, gave no reason for its decision. In February, Chadian and international rights groups took Habré to court. We'll do more on that story later in the program. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with my co-host, Juan Gonzalez.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners, and happy post-4th of July. Amy, did you go to the beach? Did you barbecue? Or did you stay home and contemplate the miracles wrought by the Founding Fathers?
Played ball, Juan. I just played ball. Softball, that is. How about you?
I barbecued. Yes, absolutely.
But this story, you know, if listeners heard Democracy Now! Yesterday, the special we do every July 4th with, Pacifica Station WBAI's program director Bernard White reading Frederick Douglass's 4th of July oration, this story about the Hartford Courant is really interesting, about them coming out with a front page story yesterday on July 4th, apologizing for its complicity in the slave trade by publishing ads for runaway slaves and to recapture slaves that had escaped.
Yes, well, up in New England, there's quite a few more people other than the Hartford Courant who have responsibilities in the slave trade. I think there's quite a few fortunes up there that were made as a result.
Well, there's no question about that. I mean, you've got the Brown brothers who founded Brown University deeply involved. But a couple months ago on Democracy Now!, when we had Deidre Farmer Pillman on, the law student who was investigating Aetna, this is really the beginning of this, because she had called Aetna to get the insurance policies given to slave owners in case their slaves, I guess, escaped or died. And the Courant did a follow-up on that, on the insurer Aetna, which, by the way, has said they will give no reparations for those slave policies. But in publishing that story, they didn't talk about their own involvement, and now we're doing it. We'll see if newspapers around the country follow suit.
Well, who knows? Maybe the Courant may be starting a trend in the whole nation on this issue of apologies and referendum and reparations. I'm sorry.
Well, the other big news this weekend, Mexico, the longest reigning single party in history, came to an end. That was the PRI. And in a little while, we'll talk about Vicente Fox, the new president of Mexico. But there was a very interesting piece in the New York Times yesterday, appropriately on the 4th of July, when U.S. military bases around the world are celebrating. And that is that the United States has touched a nerve in El Salvador by seeking to set up a military logistics point for its war on drugs in a country where American advisors, intelligence, and money not long ago helped fuel this devastating carnage in El Salvador, with the human rights abusing military and paramilitary forces there now trying to set up a military base once again. And Salvadorans are balking at this. This also following the major protests that have been taking place in Vieques, the Puerto Rican island. And yesterday, for the 4th of July celebration, hundreds of Puerto Ricans rallied outside a federal prison, which is holding activists opposed to the naving bombing of the island of Vieques.
Yes, I mean, we're in a situation now where there were about 180 or so people arrested last week. The numbers are approaching about 500 or so now who have been arrested since May, when the federal agents first moved into Vieques. And the issue is not going away. In fact, the Catholic Church did a poll on the island of Vieques, of the residents, of 2,000 of the 9,000 residents on the island, and found that 88% of them want the Navy to leave immediately. Another 4% want the Navy to leave within 3 years, and only 7% want the Navy to stay. So you're looking at something like 92% of the people of Vieques want the Navy to leave. But most of them want the Navy to leave immediately. So this issue of when will the referendum be held that President Clinton and Governor Rosselló agreed to hold on Vieques is now a critical question, because the sooner it is held, the sooner the vote will come in that the Navy must leave. And, of course, the earliest it could be held, according to the agreement, is August 1. And there are many people in Puerto Rican civil society, including some of the leading political figures, who say they want that referendum held immediately. The Navy has an 18-month window between August 1st and I think it's 2001, February, whatever 18 months is from August 1st, to call the date of that referendum. So the key thing is now the pressure on the Navy to call the referendum, because as the White House has tried to make clear in the last few days, the President of the United States does not really control the United States Navy. I mean, but all the property of the Navy and decisions about it and either selling or buying is made by Congress. And so the President cannot really tell the Navy what to do.
Can certainly put some political capital into making things happen, though. Well, we're going to move now from the military to spying, though a lot of times they go together. A French state prosecutor has launched a preliminary investigation into the workings of the United States Echelon spy system of satellites and listening posts around the world. Echelon was set up during the Cold War by the U.S. National Security Agency, known as the NSA, the largest spy organization in the world. Echelon links the NSA to its counterparts in the UK, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and can intercept millions of telephone, fax, and email messages. Washington has been accused of using it for economic espionage against its allies, spying on foreign corporations for U.S. companies, a charge that it denies. Well, the French prosecutor has ordered France's state counterintelligence agency to find out whether Echelon's activities could be qualified under French law as harmful to the vital interests of the French nation. Meanwhile, the European Parliament is due to decide today whether to set up a commission to investigate if Echelon infringes upon the rights of European citizens and industries. Late last year, a report submitted to the European Parliament by a British researcher said Echelon's eavesdropping activities had resulted in several major contracts going to U.S. rather than European firms. In particular, it cited a 94 attempt by the French-led European Airbus Consortium to break the U.S. hold on airliner sales to Saudi Arabia. In 1995, France expelled 5 U.S. diplomats and officials, one of them the alleged Paris station chief for the CIA, in connection with the chief. Well, we're going to talk about Echelon, this global spy satellite system that very few people know about, set up by the NSA, this top secret of secret agencies, much vaster than the CIA. We're going to New Zealand, and we're joined by Nick Hager, who wrote the book Secret Power, New Zealand's Role in the Global Intelligence Network. And in Washington, Jim Bamford is with us. He wrote the book The Puzzle Palace, about the workings of the National Security Agency. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's go to New Zealand first to Nick Hager. Can you lay out for us what Echelon is?
Good morning. Echelon changes the way that ordinary people think about spying, which is the idea that an intelligence agency that spies will spy on a particular person or government or office. What Echelon did, the idea of Echelon, as it's developed over the last couple of decades, is that rather than doing that, the spy agencies, the Western spy agencies led by the NSA, spy on all the major components of the world's telecommunication systems that they can get. That's the emails, links, the telephone networks, the way that fax and telex are communicated. And they don't just intercept some of it, they intercept all the components of it that they want and process it with enormous computers, searching for particular people's names, or subjects, or company names, or country names during a conflict, and take out all the messages, private messages, business messages, and government messages that they're interested in. So it moves from a spying on a person to a kind of automated industrial scale of spying.
But when you say that they are able to intercept messages, now, is this just in wireless or satellite communication? Can they do this with landlines as well? And when you're saying email, you're talking even email that is just going over phone lines and does not necessarily travel through through the air?
The actual Echelon system and the National Security Agency and its allies are foreign intelligence organizations. And so, for example, within the United States or within my country, it's not their job to spy on the local communications of the citizens within the country, although there have been instances where that has happened. Their job is to spy on international communications. So of the international communications, which go by cable, across continents by microwave, and by long-distance radio and by satellite, all of those are regarded as the job of the NSA and its allies. And they all go into what's called the Echelon system.
So in other words, what you're saying is that Britain agrees to spy on communications coming from the United States to spy on communications coming from Britain, and vice versa. So therefore, the governments cannot be accused of spying on their own citizens.
No, that's actually not what I was saying, although some of that goes on. No, the five main English-speaking allies, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Britain, haven't set up a system to spy on their own nations from each other. They've set up a system to spy on the other nations, all the rest of the nations of the world. And so, for instance, Britain, in a strangely kind of outmoded way, is the launching pad for all the spying against Western Europe, or most of the spying against Western Europe. And New Zealand spies on the South Pacific, and Canada helps spy on some of South America and so on around the world. And between the allies, they have the job of physically intercepting the large chunks of the world's telecommunications, as I say, the microwave links across continents and the satellites and so on. And then they share between them the job of writing up all the millions or over time of intercepted communications that they bring in. Intelligence reports, which they then circulate between them as the intelligence products, as they call it.
Nick Hager, can you explain how we came to this point now with, in Strasbourg, the European Parliament deciding whether to begin these investigations, how the British report was done that was laying out these possibilities of, well, corporate espionage, but also just whether these countries are using it to invade the privacy of people around the world?
Are you talking about where the information came from?
Yeah, how this has gotten the kind of momentum that now Germany, France, the European Parliament, they're all beginning these investigations.
Yeah, in spite of things like Jim Bamford's remarkable book, which he'll talk about with you soon, mostly these systems have managed to remain very secret. And so even though there's been rumors and writing about spying on Europe for a long time, it wasn't really on the record. And then when I wrote my book about the New Zealand spy agencies, which of course is on the very far side of the world, in my interviews I talked to more and more people who were sitting every day at their screens monitoring every manner of communications from all the countries in our part of the world, the governments, the militaries, the businesses, the private individuals, the human rights organizations, you name it, everything was being spied on. And so, and I put this into a book on New Zealand, which, because it was about New Zealand, got completely forgotten about. And then a couple of years later, a European Parliament researcher found an article I'd written on the basis of my book about the far-flung end of the world and this thing called Echelon, and put it into a report, which I remember very well when it came up, because suddenly my phone started ringing, and there was a great deal of interest. And to my amazement, unlike usual intelligence stories, which get denied or ignored by the authorities and tend to die, in this case it's grown. And I think the difference is that when the story comes out about U.S. spy activities in the States, it's the States, it's the American government that's doing it, and the story gets denied and closed down. And when I did it in New Zealand, I simply got faced by denials and the story was closed down. And in the Europe, where they're actually the targets of the system, people, even conservative people within the government, were not happy with this news, and instead the story has grown. And month by month, since the beginning of 1998, when the story hit in Europe, there have been people in different European intelligence agencies coming out and telling their stories about, yes, well, actually we knew there was such a thing as Echelon, and it was used in this particular situation, like, for instance, different trade deals or spying on the Pope, or all kinds of stories have since come out and fueled it, so that, first of all, it was the European Parliament, then it was a controversy in Spain and in Denmark and in Italy and other countries and Germany, and now it's back in the European Parliament for a second round. So it feels to me like perhaps for the first time I've ever known of, the issue of large-scale spying by more powerful countries, or by the powerful countries of the world, on everyone else, is growing as a political issue in major parliaments. It's a huge development.
Nick Hager, we have to break for stations to identify themselves, and when we come back, we'll also be joined by Jim Bamford, who wrote the book, The Puzzle Palace, about this top secret agency in the United States called the National Security Agency that set up Echelon. Nick Hager, we're speaking to in New Zealand. His book is Secret Power, New Zealand's Role in the International Spy Network. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, Nick Hager, who wrote the book Secret Power, New Zealand's Role in the International Spy Network, this on a day when the European Parliament is deciding whether to launch a major investigation into the Echelon spy system of satellites and listening posts around the world, first set up by the U.S. National Security Agency. And Jim Bamford, who is currently writing a book on the National Security Agency, has already written one called Puzzle Palace. Juan?
Yes, I'd like to welcome Jim Bamford to the show. And I'd like to ask you, the size of this operation is mind-boggling, because you're talking about mega wholesale listening in on conversations throughout the world in various languages. You're talking about, must be billions of of words that are constantly on a daily basis being monitored. How is it done? Is it done through specific code words that are selected out so that then they can be reviewed by live human beings? Or what's the process that that Echelon actually utilizes?
Good morning, Juan. It's a fairly complex process. It's grown over the last 50 years. It involves a large amount of satellite interception of communications and microwave interception of communications. Most of the communications in the world pass at one time or another through a satellite or a microwave link. And these are communication signals that are vulnerable to interception. If you have a microwave and it's going from one microwave tower to another, eventually that microwave will go in a straight line out into deep space, and that's where NSA has a number of satellites that pick up those signals. It's fairly easy technologically to pick them up in space because there's no interference between the microwave signal and where the satellite is in deep space. So there's a long history of technology that enables NSA to pick up the communications. Once the communications are picked up, there's a lot of filters that are in place in computers that are set up to eliminate a lot of the communications that are useless and try to narrow it down to the most useful communications, those dealing with diplomatic, military, or economic issues.
What do you think of the charges of the French government, perhaps the German government, European Commission, their concerns that the NSA, National Security Agency, is using this spying to eavesdrop on foreign companies to benefit U.S. companies?
Well, I think it's mostly nonsense. The NSA doesn't have any interest in the economic activity of most companies in Europe. It focuses on companies in Europe and other parts of the United States primarily to look for sale of prohibited items to embargoed states, the sale of chemicals to Libya or weapons parts to Iran or whatever. Most people talk about Echelon in sort of the macro aspect of it, the enormous picking up zillions and zillions of communications. When it comes down to it, you've got about 38,000 people that work for NSA. Only a handful of those are actually the analysts. At one point, somebody has to look at a piece of communications before it gets sent to the White House or someplace else. So you've got to narrow it down to a very small amount of communications. And those communications are primarily aimed at what foreign governments are doing. When the National Security Council meets, the president or the National Security Advisor, the first question is not, how is Airbus doing? It's, have you found bin Laden yet? Or have you discovered when the next missile test from North Korea is going to take place?
But people have charged that the CIA, much smaller than the National Security Agency, is increasingly being used as an intelligence gathering arm for U.S. corporations. Why would it be so far-fetched?
Well, it's far-fetched because there is no evidence that there is any economic intelligence being picked up and given to U.S. corporations. Most of the charges revolve around a couple of small anecdotal pieces of information that are not backed up by any kind of evidence. I spent a lot of time looking into NSA, and believe me, I would not be the first one in line if I saw there was evidence of this going on. I'm giving you my honest opinion. I don't think, having talked to a great many people who have worked there in the past and having access to a fair amount of information that NSA's come up with, I've never seen any evidence of this taking place. It's actually the opposite problem is the issue. NSA has reduced in size a great deal over the last 10 years. In addition, communications are becoming harder and harder to eavesdrop on because of the increase in encryption and the increase of fiber optics, which are far more difficult to intercept. In addition to that, the NSA can't even do the job that it's supposed to be doing. It completely missed the nuclear test that took place a few years ago in India. So you've got an agency that's fairly stretched fairly thin, and it's got an enormous amount of targets. Now that the Cold War has ended, its targets have increased enormously. It used to be, you know, all Soviet Union. That was the principal target. But now it's, you know, they could be listening to some third world country in Africa, or they could be trying to find out what the North Koreans are doing on missile tests, or the Indians are doing, and the Pakistanis are doing, and looking for terrorists and so forth. There are a lot of issues involved with Echelon, but economic espionage is not one of them. Human rights violations, I think, or human rights issues, I think, are far more important. What NSA does, picking up individual conversations in Europe, I think that's the key issue. Protecting people from eavesdropping by this enormous system. United States citizens are fairly well protected, but the rest of the world isn't. And I think that should be the focus, and to some degree that is the focus of the French investigation. But the picking up Airbus and passing it on to Boeing is not the issue.
Well, Jim, precisely on this issue of this enormous, it seems almost like an arrogant view that you can actually in some way or other monitor so much of the world's conversations. But in terms of the NSA itself as an agency, could, for those of our listeners who are not familiar with it, what is its stated role? What's its relationship to the CIA? Who is it responsible to within the federal government? Could you tell us a little bit about the agency itself?
Well, the agency is very unique. The CIA, for example, was created in 1947 by an act of Congress. Unlike that, the NSA was created by a secret order. It was a seven-page memorandum classified above top secret written by Harry Truman in 1952. So where NSA was, or where CIA was born in public, basically, NSA was born in total secrecy, and it has remained an enormously secret agency ever since then. The CIA basically reports to the president, to the National Security Council, and deals mostly with two things. One is human intelligence, which is sending out spies, and very little of that these days. And the other is analysis. It's the body that receives all the other agencies' intelligence reports and puts together final reports. Those are mainly the two functions of the CIA. The NSA, on the other hand, is the principal collector of intelligence for the United States, because most of the intelligence collected today is collected by what they call signals intelligence. That's the technical word for eavesdropping. And NSA, it's a very high quality of intelligence. You can go out, you're in the CIA, and recruit somebody, and he could be working for the other side, or he could be making things up. You don't really know. NSA, by intercepting supposedly private communications, sometimes supposedly secure communications, you're getting a far greater quality of intelligence. And because so much of it goes through the air, it's fairly easy to pick up. At least it had been in the past. It's getting more difficult. It was just like during World War II. The United States, the large reason for the United States winning World War II and Great Britain winning World War II was by breaking, intercepting foreign communications and breaking foreign codes, particularly the German Enigma code and the Japanese Purple code. And it's continued to today. So the NSA operates in a fairly strange world. It was born by a top secret order, and virtually everything it does is considered top secret. There's only Nick Hager was one of the few people who was able to penetrate part of that by examining very closely the workings in New Zealand, and he did a very good book on that.
James Bamford, author of The Puzzle Palace, about one of the most top-secret agencies and largest in the world, the National Security Agency. He's speaking to us from Washington. Nikki Hager is on the line with us from New Zealand, who wrote Secret Power, who was one of the first to expose the whole echelon system that is now coming under increasing scrutiny from the European community. Nick Hager, do you feel as confident as Jim Bamford on the issue of corporate espionage actually not really being one of the focuses of the echelon system and not happening now?
I have to admit that my answer on that is that I don't know. On my side of the world, where I was talking to people in these New Zealand and Australian agencies, that means spying on the South Pacific, the Pacific area and Southeast Asia, it wasn't a major part of the work. And so I'm like him. I haven't really got the evidence that it's firsthand that what the Europeans are complaining about is true. Where I do differ from him a bit is that I did talk for hours and hours and hours with people who spent all their days handling the intelligence coming off the wires from the US, from the National Security Agency, and also handling the intelligence coming out of Echelon to the New Zealand analysts. And my experience was that the official stories of what intelligence was for, that's like tracking illegal commodities going to certain rogue countries, or terrorism, or those kind of legitimate sounding topics, was not the core business at all. In fact, I heard practically no examples of that in the foreign intelligence arriving in New Zealand, that's particularly the United States generated intelligence, or in the New Zealand part. Instead, it was the primary business, it wasn't military either, the primary business was spying on the internal politics of all the different countries of the world, and in our case, in our region, which means that I don't blame the French and the other European countries at all for feeling that their rights are being infringed, because if it's like our side of the world, everyone from the Prime Minister down and the opposition parties and the regional organizations like the European Parliament itself and the non-governmental organizations like the Greenpeaces and Amnesty Internationals and so on, all of those have been comprehensively spied on all the time. And although in New Zealand we didn't have a very large analyst staff at all, and the number of staff is much smaller than the NSA, they were still able, through the use of technology rather than people, to do a very comprehensive job of spying on our neighbours, most of whom, officially, New Zealand was very close and warm friends with, but within the secret intelligence alliance, we were spying on all their activities all the time.
Well, you know, the idea that our government can be participating on an international level in spying on the private activities of organizations in other countries, something that the government could not do in this country legally, but yet it does it with impunity around the world, and there seems to be no outcry. What's been the reaction, for instance, in New Zealand and Australia among the public to these revelations?
At a public level, annoyance, because and it's exactly the same as happened in Britain, for instance, there's such a gulf between the official stories about what our foreign policies are and who are our friends and enemies in the world. There's a gulf between that and who's actually spied on. And what it turns out to be is, for instance, in New Zealand's case, we spy on our South Pacific neighbours, we spy on our main trading partner, Japan. But when I was interviewing people, one third of the effort was put into spying on Japan. And what became horribly apparent was that those priorities were not New Zealand's intelligence priorities or who New Zealanders saw as enemies in the world. It was completely based on the priorities coming from the National Security Agency in Washington. Now, to me, it's exactly mirrored in the case of the European Union member Britain, which puts a lot of its effort into spying on its fellow European Union partners in Western Europe. And that's why I think there's such a potent sort of political tension there between the old alliance roles that New Zealand and Britain carried from the Second World War and 50 years later, our current relationships in the world, which are out of sync with the spy activities.
Well, Nick Hager and James Bamford, we want to thank you for being with us. Nick Hager, just listening to from New Zealand, has written the book Secret Power, New Zealand's role in the international spy network, and James Bamford's book, The Puzzle Palace, will be updated with a new book he is writing on the National Security Agency. We'll let listeners know what the European Parliament decides today, whether to launch this investigation into Echelon, but the French government already has, and the German government is also doing the same. When we come back, we're going to look at the latest news from Mexico, where the longest ruling political party in the world voted out of power. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. And Juan, over the weekend, July 2nd, Mexicans voted out the longest ruling political party in the world. After 71 years, the PRI, it will be out of power when the new president, who represents the PAN, the right-wing populist party, takes office, Vicente Fox. Some are calling it like the difference between new and old Coke, which is particularly relevant considering Vicente Fox, the new president, was the head of Coca-Cola in Mexico. Well, he held his first news conference yesterday announcing plans to rebuild the country's federal law enforcement system, saying it'll be modeled on the U.S. system. Specifically, Fox said he intends to create a Ministry of Security and Justice similar to the FBI. He also said he plans to travel to the United States soon to meet with President Clinton and both major presidential candidates to discuss his proposals to open the U.S.-Mexico border. He said he would try to advance the North American Free Trade Agreement to cover labor and small businesses. We go to Mexico City right now to talk to John Ross, who has just writing a new book called The War Against Oblivion, Zapatista Chronicles, 94 to 2000. And wrote the book Roots of Rebellion. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
Yep, I'm here again. Michael Moore Clause. I do this for Democracy Now! I don't do it for the undemocratic board of the National Pacifica Foundation.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us. Can you give us your reaction to the voting out of PRI and Vicente Fox coming to power?
Well, I think it's an historical event, and the way that it's being handled, I think, in the U.S. press, I saw the Times yesterday, is really it's just another example of the kind of elitism that the U.S. press and the foreign press tends to impose upon the Mexican situation. This is a change that needs to be looked at down below, not up above, and that's where people seem to be focused. I hear a lot of cynicism about new Coke and old Coke, but actually, if you take a look in terms of how people feel about this, I think it's quite different. Seven decades of authoritarian tyranny by a party is gone. It's out the window. I stood at the PRI on Sunday night and watched them turn out the lights. Yeah, I think that was not only a symbolic assumption, but it was also, a very real assumption. The last days since the election, Monday and Tuesday, we're seeing the PRI virtually tear itself apart into perhaps three or four different factions that could become parties themselves. We saw that actually at the PRI on Sunday night. It already begun to fight between people that feel that Cedillo, President Cedillo, conceded the election much too early to Fox, and he's being blamed now by the PRI itself as having given the election through his economic policies and through his control of the party to the PAN. And I think we're going to see that become a very serious situation in the next couple of weeks. The PRI is a dinosaur party, and the dinosaurs are wounded, and that makes them, I think, a lot more dangerous. We may see some actual physical violence here between the various factions in the next couple of weeks.
Well, John, a couple of surprising announcements by Fox in his first press conference. He talked about, one, that he'd be willing possibly to withdraw Mexican troops from Chiapas as part of a new initiative on his part to try to negotiate a resolution of the ongoing conflict with the Zapatistas in Chiapas, and also that he would be pushing with the United States for breaking down the barriers to Mexican immigration to the United States, basically saying that the barriers to workers should be torn down as well as those to capital. Any reaction to those announcements?
Well, I think a lot of the statements that are being made right now are very early. Vicente Fox has no base within the military at all. Trying to withdraw the military from Chiapas at this point will create conflicts with the military. It might even force the military is going to have to define its power in this new administration. And the rule of thumb here is that the president's loyalty to the military is certainly as important as the military's loyalty to the presidency. And he does not have at this point the ability, the political clout, to withdraw the military.
And the military is still dominated by PRI generals, I assume.
I don't think that's true. I mean, it's dominated by people that have been affiliated with the regime, with the presidency, over a long period of time. Fox has said that he's going to change the way that the Secretary of Defense has changed. It's usually nominated by the military itself. But I think that there are factions for the left-wing party, the PRD, within the military itself. You have to remember that the main leftist figure, Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas, his father was a general. None of the other politicians involved in the show here have any relationship to the military. And the Cárdenas party has picked up, I think, a proportion, at least, of the hierarchy within the military, and always does very well around the military bases in terms of the troops voting.
What kind of word do you have from the Zapatistas in response to the PAN victory?
We haven't heard anything yet, and I don't expect we'll hear anything for a week or so. I would think that one of the ways that we have to look at this is that in 1994, on January 1st, 1994, when the Zapatistas declared war on the government, they in effect declared war on the PRI government. And I think that's a clear distinction. Here we have talked about for the last seven decades or thereabouts a government that's called the PRI government. The PAN government, which hasn't, of course, developed itself yet, is still a complete unknown. So I think that there's going to be some opening on their part to explore some possibilities. I have thought since the beginning of this that Fox will try and bring in somebody with the moral caliber of Cuauhtémoc Cárdenas to try and negotiate the situation with them. Cárdenas is in favor of military withdrawal, and he does have these connections within the military. Nonetheless, the PRD is being very standoffish in this situation. They are kind of treating Fox as they did Salinas, saying that they'll take no positions within the government, and Cárdenas refused to acknowledge. Well, he acknowledged Fox's victory, but he refused to meet with him and shake his hand. I think we're going to see a situation here for a number of months where the PRD is going to stand outside this the new presidency.
Well, John Ross, I want to thank you for being with us. John Ross, an independent journalist in Mexico City. His book that is coming out soon, The War Against Oblivion, Zapatista Chronicles, 1994 to 2000. Thank you. Speaking to us from Mexico City. And we now move on to the last subject of today's program. A Senegalese court yesterday dismissed torture charges against the exiled Chadian dictator Hissène Habré. The decision came after a panel headed by the Senegalese president, removed the judge investigating the case and promoted the head of the indicting chamber, which issued yesterday's ruling. The judge, Demba Kanji, who sparked the initial investigation against the Chadian dictator, has been called the Baltasar Garzon of Senegal, Baltasar Garzon being the Spanish judge who attempted to have Augusto Pinochet extradited to Spain. Well, victims groups are protesting the dropping of the charges against Habré and the removal of the judge. The group has announced it will appeal this latest decision. We're going to go to Senegal right now, as well as to Reed Brody, who's in New York. He's advocacy director of Human Rights Watch, very closely involved with this case, recently returned from Senegal. We welcome you to Democracy Now, Reed. Can you explain what happened?
Yes, the court ruled that Senegal did not have jurisdiction over torture that was committed in Chad. What is very troubling, as you mentioned, is that right before the ruling, the key judges in this case were transferred. Unfortunately, since the new government of Abdoulaye Wade came in, ending in a parallel with Mexico, ending 40 years of one-party rule, the government has changed its position on this case. When the case was first filed, the state prosecutor supported the charges against Habré. Since the election of Wade, the prosecution has taken Habré's side. Habré's lawyer was named as a presidential counselor while continuing to represent Habré. And then in really the final slap, the judge investigating the case was summarily transferred out of the case. So there have been a lot of shenanigans here that are not worthy of Senegalese democracy.
Well, why would a democratically elected president take such an action?
It's really hard to know, and maybe Al Youn has some insights. Hissen Habré stole $11 million from Chad at the same time that he was torturing and committing murder. He also plundered the country's economy and stole $11 million, which he's spreading around in Senegal at the moment, and that may have some bearing on what's happened.
It's interesting because at the same time this comes out, the misery index of a UN panel comes out, and Chad is one of the poorest countries in the world. As you said, Reed, we are also joined on the phone by Al Youn Tine, who is with us from Dakar, Senegal. He's with the African Assembly for the Defense of Human Rights. What is your response to the court dismissing the charges against Habré, Al Youn Tine?
It is a great scandal because Senegal is the first country in the world to ratify the status of the International Criminal Court, and the second country in Africa to ratify the status of the African Court. And, you know, yesterday, before the decision of the court, the two judges in charge of Hissène Habré case were muted. And it is a great scandal, and we are very shocked. And Mr. Demba Kanji is known to be a very good judge with competence and very independent. It is very important in Africa to have an independent judge in charge of this affair. And now we see that there is the immixtion of the politics, the executive, in the problem of justice in Senegal. Because, you know, Mr. Madi Kenyan, the advocate of Mr. Hissène Habré, is the advocate of Abdoulaye Wade and is the counselor of Abdoulaye Wade.
And Abdoulaye Wade being the president of Senegal.
He's the president of Senegal. They have the same advocate. And the advocate, he has great influence in the decision of justice in Senegal. It's why it is a scandal. It's why we have a conflict of interest between justice and executive power. And now all the civil society of Senegal have indignation about this decision.
I'd like to ask you, Al Youn Tine, How important is this decision in terms of the former Chadian dictator? What is he accused of while he was a dictator of Chad?
He is accused of torture and atrocity and disappearance of persons. About 40,000 persons disappeared, and many people were tortured in Chad. And we have victims here in Senegal who made testimony about the torture and what they have suffered in the presence of in Chad. And it was very, very impressive to hear these men and these women that have lost their children, their husbands, and the disappearance of their husbands. And it was very, very impressive. And the Senegal is competent, Senegalese court are competent to indict Issenadre, because the Article 9-7 of our Constitution disposed that all the conventions and that are ratified by our country have more value than our national laws. And the advocate of Issenadre, their argument was based on our national law, or as a national law have less value than the international convention that is ratified by Issenadre, is why the argument is not a juridical argument, but a political argument. And it is a great, we are very, very, very shocked by that.
Al Yountine with us from Dakar, Senegal, where the government has just dropped the charges against the Chadian dictator who has taken refuge in Senegal, Hissène Habré. Reid Brody in New York of Human Rights Watch, what about the U.S. role in support of Habré?
Well, Hissène Habré ruled Chad from 1982 to 1990, and he was heavily supported by the United States and France as a bulwark against Colonel Gaddafi. One of Ronald Reagan's first covert actions was in support of Hissène Habré in order, in the words of Alexander Haig, to bloody Gaddafi's nose. While he was in power, as Al Youn mentioned, according to a Chadian Truth Commission, he is accused of 40,000 killings and disappearances, as well as systematic torture. When he left the country in 1990 and moved to Senegal, what's interesting is that now Habré is painting this case as an imperialist move supported by the United States and France, when in fact, during the entire time he was in power, he was being supported by the United States and France. And unfortunately, this case, the indictment, was a beacon of hope in Africa, in a continent in which the cycle of impunity has been the rule, in which dictators have plundered their countries and then just moved next door. The fact that Senegal had indicted Habré for these crimes had given hope to human rights activists all over the continent. Unfortunately, yesterday's actions and particularly the bizarre maneuvers surrounding it with the removal of judges has been a very big disappointment to those of us who believe that Senegal could lead the way here.
Al Yountine, we just have a few seconds. How realistic is an appeal of the dropping of the charges?
My appeal is that I think that the international opinion must make a pressure on Senegalese government to respect the independence of the justice. I think that it is a great attack against independent justice in Senegal, what we have done.
We have to wrap up the show, but I want to thank you very much for being with us and let people know you can get more information on this from the Human Rights Watch website at hrw.org. Again, Senegal dropping charges of torture against the former Chadian dictator Hissène Habré. Al-Yuntine with us from Dakar, Senegal, his group African Assembly for the Defense of Human Rights. Reed Brody with us from Human Rights Watch. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And you can write to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by David Love and Jeremy Scahill. We had help from Nell Geiser. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director from the studios of WBAI in New York. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.